Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Joining me today on All About Business is James Uffindale, founder and CEO of Bright Network, an innovative organization on the UK job market scene that connects data, talent, and businesses in exciting new ways. Having successfully collaborated with leading employers such as Google, Apple, and Amazon, James shares valuable insights and his knowledge for both young talent and businesses on how to find a good path forward. Today on All About Business, I'm really, really pleased to welcome James Uffindale, who is the CEO and founder of Bright Network. This is a network and a platform that supports young people and students in their early career progress, I suppose it's fair to say. But I'm going to ask you my first question to you, James, is, apart from welcoming you, what is Bright Network? Explain.
Thanks, James, and really great to be here. Bright Network is a tech, AI, and data platform, and we are the number one way that undergraduates and students connect with jobs and opportunities. So we've set up the platform because we believe that talent is everywhere, kind of opportunity isn't, and how we can use tech, AI, and data to better build the workforce of tomorrow.
Yeah, so go on. How do you do that? Well, how do you use tech, AI, and data to build the workforce? I've got lots of questions arising.
No, it's great. Well, then let's get into
from
them.
From this statement.
Let's get into them. And it's great to obviously particularly have the conversation with you, given everything kind of you and your business has achieved and is achieving in the world of recruitment. So there's kind of lots of overlap
there.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm interested in that.
Yeah. So they say founders kind of solve their own problems. So I guess the background to Bright Network goes back to the experience I had when I was at university. When I grew up, it was a kind of single parent working family. My mum and dad had separated when I was three. We were living in rented accommodation when my mum...
Where was this?
Up in Warwickshire. Warwickshire. And when mum remarried, the biggest kind of qualification in our household was my stepdad's taxi driving license. So neither of my parents had been to university, but I got lucky. I got to go to a good school and I got to had an amazing teacher and he encouraged me to apply to a top university. So I was lucky enough to get into Oxford and went off to Oxford, but still didn't come from that kind of like professional services. I describe as moneyed background. And at university, I was working in the local pub. I also had worked as a controller for my stepfather's taxi driving business where he worked.
Well, you answered the phone.
Yeah, basically answering the phone.
So all through the night stuff.
Yeah, well, actually, no, I never did night shifts, actually. I used to do Sundays because that's when the tax drivers all come on for a bit of day off and I send them in the wrong directions and stuff. I learned my skill was definitely
not
in operations.
So you call that a controller?
I was the controller.
That's now done by Uber.
Exactly, and it's now a great example of AI and automation. Anyway, I went off to university and I had no idea what to do. When I left university, the career service at the time kind of wasn't very engaging. Unless you wanted to do kind of banking or finance, it was very narrow. And I had an idea for a startup. And I started an organization helping other students apply to top tier universities. And the school I went to didn't send a lot of students. The service was focused on Oxford and Cambridge, didn't send a lot of students to Oxford and Cambridge. And I thought there's an opportunity here to help students non-traditional backgrounds kind of access kind of Oxford and Cambridge, basically.
So this is quite a small market, I imagine.
Yes. Yeah.
And are the people you're talking to well-heeled, if that's right? Yeah. Were they able to pay for this?
Yes.
Or did you not charge them? Or how did that work?
So the way it worked was we had a model where we worked with a lot of local education authorities and schools. So we worked with about kind of 200 schools going into schools and encouraging them to apply to top tier universities into the schools. And then we did have a model where if people kind of wanted to come to us individually, they could, but also if anybody couldn't afford it, they got the service for free. And looking back now, we're all searching for growth, right? In this economy we're in, it was absolutely rampant. And it was a nice cash model in terms of often kind of you got paid up front. So I was able to grow that business through my 20s. And I sold that business to private equity in about 10 years ago.
So what was that called?
It was a business called Oxbridge Applications.
And is it still going?
Yeah, it's still going. It's continued to grow and develop and prosper. And a nice reminder that kind of hopefully if you build a premium asset, it's good for everybody. To answer your question then, I was then kind of early 30s and I was like, well, what do I want to do next? And these students were coming to me saying, what do I do next? How do I get into the world of work? And these are all hopefully like pretty bright, hungry, ambitious students. And I realized back to the question you asked me about where did Bright Network come from, I realized that the problems I had experienced at university were still very prevalent And in terms of social mobility, democratization, how do you access and make sure that everybody has kind of opportunity, that problem still existed. And what I'd learned through my own journey of kind of, I guess, being at Oxford and seeing how certain kind of families operated, I call it like the tap on the shoulder. There's a guy who's at university with me and he went off to do a paid internship. I was working at the Red Lion pub in Stratford-on-Avon and he went to do a legal internship. And that was because his older sister was a lawyer and she had said, if you want to get into law, you need to do a vacation scheme. And this is what you do. So then I thought about how often social mobility can be facilitated and the networks that happen in kind of often wealthy, well-connected families and the data that happens in wealthy, well-connected families, because young people in those families are often getting these taps on the shoulder from, you know, you're at maths, you're at a top university, Uncle Dave might run a private equity firm, go and work at Uncle Dave's private equity firm. And I was like, actually, what you can do here is put all these amazing, bright young people from all walks of life on a platform and then use the data to personalize experience. So that's what we do on Bright Network. You sign up for Bright Network, and then we use four different types of data to better match you to opportunities in terms of jobs, learning.
You being the student at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. To better match you to opportunities. And then it's all free for the student members. So we've got over 1 million on the platform now. And we have an amazing client roster, about 300 blue chips enterprise level clients, pairs to access talent.
So I had a little dig around on your website. It seemed to be very much promoting internships in the early summer, and you were encouraging people to sign up for internships.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is
yeah.
That your, so what's the business model there? These people sign up and then they get placed into companies. Is that what you hope happens? And you can, charge an introduction fee?
We don't work on the kind of introduction fee basis. The way the business model works is, interestingly, you've got about 500,000 kind of graduates coming out of UK universities a year. Now, there are about 50,000 graduate schemes. So if you think about a kind of a graduate program. Now, the vast majority of these graduate programs are filled by people who've already worked at that organization. So if you want to get into a top tier organization, the reality is applying your third year is too late. So doing an internship, so classically a second year program, is the way to get ahead. But then actually, interestingly with that, a lot of those internship places in the second year are actually given to students who have done the first year program. So actually, from a social mobility angle, if you want to break into one of these organizations that is all in these skyscrapers that we have around us right here in the heart of London, you actually need to do a first year internship. So part of the mission is then encouraging students when they land on campus to get ahead and to get stuck into their career early. Because if they don't do the first year internship, they're less likely to get the second year internship attention, then less likely to get the final year a graduate replacement scheme. And actually, if you think about the war for talent that's going on, and I was reading your article the other day about what we've got happening around decreasing demand for jobs and kind of, and obviously in terms of the empty vacancy rate going from about, I think it's about 1.3 million to about 700,000 now, there is still, however, incredibly intense competition for the top talent. So in terms of the mission, the data and the AI technology allows bright young people to understand how this works in terms of getting their first job, but also the employers to compete for that talent more efficiently.
So you would recommend to a young person that they should get an internship at the end of their first year, go back in the second, and then get a job in the third? Is that how
Yeah, I think there's a no-brainer if you're 18, landing at university, to really start exploring your career. So that gives kind of three main benefits. You can build what we call CV capital. So you can boost your CV and show kind of dedicated experience in the sector and doing kind of a first year internship. Secondly, it helps you understand if that job is good for you or not, because you're actually kind of doing the work, you're in the organization. I did a week as a accountancy work experience when I was basically 16, 17. It taught me I'd be the world's worst accountant. So actually kind of understanding whether that job's a good fit or not. And thirdly, skills. You're developing your skills, which might be transferable to another sector.
Yeah, so I'm sort of listening to this and thinking, I have two sort of anxieties bubbling up. One is the nature of 18 and 19 year olds. You know, they all going to want to do this sort of, you know, as a parent, I'm thinking, how would I get my 19-year-old to go and do that?
Oh, 100%, yeah.
So I imagine a lot of them have sort of got other ideas.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, a lot of these businesses, you know, these Uncle Daves that you referred to, are thinking, I don't need so many graduates now because we're going to automate. So there's a sort of couple of challenges there. How do you deal with those challenges? How do you make this type of routeway appealing to the young people? And how do you keep the Uncle Daves coming back for more?
Yeah, you've touched on two huge areas there in terms of...
Yeah, take them one at a time.
Yeah, I'll go for the first one, then we can obviously maybe come back to the AI automation piece, which is obviously particularly prevalent given everything that's happening.
We're delighted that you're listening to this episode. Hit the follow button so that we can continue to bring you the best business insight and actionable advice to help your business and or career.
So the great thing with the data on the Bright Network platform, we've got about 1 billion+ bits of data now, and that's obviously topping up live all the time in terms of students on the platform, is that you can then segment the audience, and we call them the kind of non-engagers. So they're, as part of the audience on the network, there are the students who might sign up, but then kind of not really engage much. So with that audience there, it's about incentives. And particularly with Gen Z, how do you create the kind of right incentives for them to engage? And making sure.
It's
personalization.
I'm fascinated. I mean,
Bright Network is all about personalization at scale. So, a classic, you'd then kind of, if you had somebody, say, for example, your daughter is on the platform and signed up and not really engaged them, you might send them an article being, for example, you know, five reasons to make sure you do a first year program. And that kind of like slightly clickbaity, right? They need to read it. Now, you wouldn't send that to a student who knew had already applied for 5 or 10 first-year internships.
Sure.
So it's the personalization at scale. And that's for the Bright Network platform. We have kind of 4 data sets we use. We use the declared data. So they might say, look, I'm at this university, I'm studying maths, and I want to go into investment banking. But then you get, secondly, the behavioral data. So what are they actually doing on the platform to understand, you know, are they reading certain content? Are they clicking on certain jobs? The level of engagement that's happening. Then psychometric data is fascinating. So we've built a 2-minute career pathway test to help you decide what career you might want to go into. Fourthly, learning data. So we do
2 minutes.
Yeah, 2-minute test. Yeah. It's kind of modern web products, and you can give it more information. Right. But in this world of kind of, you know, so much attention deficit and people have short attention spans, a 2-minute test to kind of look at a first, like what career choice could be of interest. And again, you think if you grew up in a certain family, you've got lots of people in, from certain sectors around you, you're having that given to you. And then finally is learning data. So you do about 1 million hours of online learning on the platform every year. So we use that to then try and personalize the content to where the student is. So for example, if a student is just looking at or engaging with content, for example, in the charity sector, we're not going to then start sending them content about consultancy or banking or law, because they're not going to engage with it, because we know they are kind of hyper-focused. So it's personalization at scale, I guess, much like, you know, Instagram works or something like that.
Yeah. I remember doing those tests when I was at school.
Yeah.
I think it was a paper.
Yeah.
My brother and I did it. Told him he should be a librarian.
Yeah.
And it told me I should be a truck driver.
There you go. Well,
the weird thing is he's been a librarian for 30 plus years and thoroughly enjoyed it. And I love a road trip. But
there
I've
you go. Exactly. I'm sure if there is something in it, it would be very successful.
I urge people to try a bit more, you know, jobs and opportunities before they settle on one thing.
There's so much choice out there.
Exactly. That's the thing I think a lot of people miss. Sometimes get locked into a view that I'm struggling to get something, when actually there's a world of opportunities, and it's about taking a bit of time and approaching them strategically,
yeah.
I would say. I mean,
absolutely. That's what we've tried to systemize. So the reality is, with young people, 90% of them, the primary source of careers advice is the parent. So, you know, if you've got a parent who's kind of a butcher or whatever like that, that is going to be the primary place.
Well, that used to be very common that people would do the same. I mean, it's still fairly common.
Even the surnames, right?
Yeah.
Baker and Butcher, I guess, being an example.
But it was very common that you'd follow in the same line of work.
Yeah.
It's become less common, I suppose, because of so much change.
Absolutely. And what excites me is, I guess, having done economics at university, is it's a matching problem in terms of you've got all these great jobs out there, you've got all this great talent, supply and demand. How do you create more efficient matches? And for the employers and the companies we're lucky enough to work with, what it does is, as well as allowing them to get in front of that super high performance, kind of diverse candidate pool, which is, you know, comes from.
So, how does it work with the employers? Do they subscribe to your
site? Yeah, and apologies. Yes. Yeah. So they.
Would you explain the model from there?
It's a yearly subscription model.
Right.
So, essentially, they are buying a kind of a yearly access to the platform. Then they're able to do a number of things. The primary one is they're able to kind of segment our database. So, they can take our network of 1.2 million now and actually be like, we want to get to more candidates who have X, Y, and Z qualities, and then we can send them a very, very targeted, bespoke email. And these email rates have about a 3x average open rate compared to kind of job boards, because we're getting so much data based on those data sets. So when you get that targeted email, it's a bit like getting an email from an older brother or sister, because we're not kind of spamming you, because we're sending you super personalized information. You're more likely to engage with it and it's more relevant to you. So back to the personalization point.
And also, but what would it say in the email?
It would say, for example, hi, James, as you're in your second year and your interest in jobs and investment banking, you might want to know that the internship for XYZ Bank, one of our 300 enterprise clients, closes next week. Click here to apply.
Right.
So that's our classic kind of model, but it's super, super personalized.
So you're prompting them a lot.
Yeah. So sometimes these e-shots, these kind of e-alerts can be down to just like 12 people, I think, is our minimum. There was a consultancy firm and they wanted to target people at a certain university and they were having coffee in the local coffee shop and they wanted more female.
How many of those 12 showed up?
I don't know the answer, actually. I think in terms of kind of that email, yeah, I think it got a pretty high kind of open rate from memory. And then they were encouraged to apply and turn up and meet.
So you won't know necessarily who gets jobs where out of this.
So we do track to, we've built quite a cool tool. So some employers will tell us who's got jobs where. When I went into the business.
Because you're not charging an introduction fee.
No, we don't.
That's not a moment that you sort of.
Yeah, our model is based on, it's a marketing platform model fee. And one of the things I noticed in the graduate recruitment industry, it was a classic, that famous quote, you know, I know these firms seem to be saying, I know half my marketing budget's a waste of money, I just don't know which half. So tracking what we call attribution is a key part of the business. So what firms can do is they can actually, through our system, anonymously and all GDPR compliant, work out who they've hired from where. And that then allows them to know that we are getting them great results. And our whole business model is built on, we get them great results, they get a great service, they renew the following year. And we're then able to actually look at certain of our members and actually track their journey. Like, for example, they signed up, they kind of like looked at a certain profile, and then you can actually see all the way through to hire.
So is a member what you call a customer?
A member is a Bright Network member. So you join the platform.
As what, a business or a person are we talking about?
As a person, yeah.
So what do you call the businesses?
Client partners.
Okay.
Yeah, so you've got about 300.
So you become a member of the platform.
Yeah, you sign up for the member.
So you said there are 1.2 million members. Yeah. I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah. But
some of those will be quite recent graduates. Yeah. And I guess some, I mean, you've been going more than a decade.
Yeah.
Will be quite sort of.
Yeah, so in terms of our active, so we signed up about 250,000 members last year. So we've really cracked acquisition as a business. And I guess it's, you know, thinking about kind of the world of business, it's that idea of being customer obsessed. And when we started, I was like, okay, what do these young people need? How do you give it to them? They wanted more personalization, bigger access to kind of opportunities in terms of kind of making sure. So on the Bright Network platform, we make sure we list as many opportunities as we can in terms of putting that stuff in front of our members. And the personalization thing, and also events. So we actually do events for about 100,000 a year in person and virtual. So
Sort of events?
So we'd always done events, and these are essentially very kind of focused sector events where, for example, women in technology, black talent in banking, women in leadership, like very focused events using the data to really put the right candidates in front of the right employers. So for example, we do the women in technology events is all about how do big corporates get access to more often kind of STEM females who want to pursue a career in technology. However, back to crisis being the mother of invention. When the pandemic hit, we, as much of the world was, were thrown into kind of complete kind of disruption. But we really wanted to make sure we stood up for our community. So we launched a program called Internship Experience UK, which was set about during the pandemic because employers are saying we can't have these young people into the offices for the internships.
No, I remember that. Yeah.
And
it needed to be done virtually.
Yes,
we
exactly.
Did that as well.
The young people couldn't go into offices. And we realized there was a huge opportunity to connect them virtually. So we launched a program called Internship Experience UK. It became the biggest internship experience globally. Over 150,000 young people have now done it. We've continued to run it every summer.
So you run that from the, it was an idea that arose in the pandemic.
Yeah.
You just kept going with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's,
so how does that work? If you want to do one of these internships,
yeah.
What do you need to do?
Absolutely. Well, you need to sign up for Bright Network. And we do it this year. It starts on the 14th of July to the 17th of July. We have different streams, for example, kind of banking and
we
different,
might miss
different
that
sectors. Well yeah, sorry if you've already missed it, but it depends when it goes out.
Well, it doesn't matter when. So it's once a year, is it?
Yeah, it's once a year.
In July.
In July. And it allows our members, our Brand Network members, to get kind of really valuable kind of work experience with the employers. They come on and do sessions, and it allows them to sample what certain sectors
are
like.
What age are the people?
So typically undergraduates, so typically kind of 18 to 21 year olds. But it was a fascinating lesson when that hit in terms of business and entrepreneurship, because I remember reading an article about there was a famous volcano in 1815. I think it was called Mount Tamura, and it erupted. And that year, 1815, it was known as the year with no summer. And obviously there was this kind of global catastrophe. And what happened was it created what's called a volcanic winter in 1816, putting up so much ash into the environment that crops all over the world were dying. And as a result, horses were too expensive to feed. So a lot of kind of horses were dying. And out of this incredible, horrific crisis came the bicycle. So the bicycle was actually invented, as a result of this global phenomenon.
So I don't get the connection.
Yeah. So I'm talking about... Well,
your poor horse died, so you had to get a bike.
Yeah, essentially. Well, the bike was invented, yeah, as an alternative mode of transport.
Because of that?
Yeah, they think, yeah, that was... what happened with us then when the pandemic hit was we launched our internship experience UK, but that then propelled us to being number one in the market in terms of how young people get their first job, because it became such scale. We didn't kind of charge anybody for it, and it really propelled us to being kind of front of the market. So I thought it was a nice reminder in terms of business that change is the only constant, and when something happens, it can actually lead to kind of unplanned.
So that's an interesting observation, and I think looking around now, it seems like change is happening, you know, really fast and in a really substantial way.
Yeah,
taking that sort of lesson, what would be your advice to people now? And what's the new bicycle?
Yeah, it's a great question. What is the new bicycle? One of the best quotes I've heard is that your job's not going to get taken by AI. It's going to get taken by somebody using AI. So all of us have to kind of become...
Do you believe that?
I actually do.
That's the optimistic version.
Yeah.
The pessimistic version is it's going to be taken by AI.
In the short term, I think kind of the research seems to show that often these things can kind of not be... can take a time to kind of bed in. And I think personally, I think the impact of AI is quite insidious. It's happening kind of almost like under the counter, kind of often kind of unnoticed incrementally. So for example, if you take software developers, Copilot, making them 30% more productive, kind of copywriters. So
you have fewer of them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it makes kind of the existing workforce more efficient or just quite frankly-
Which would explain why there are fewer vacancies.
Yeah. And it's fascinating moments like what is behind that kind of fewer vacancy number. My own observation, I guess, being in the market, is that the big blue chips we work with are kind of very stable. You know, if you have a graduate program, you're hiring 1,000 graduates a year, you're probably going to be pretty stable around that.
But that's not what's being reported, though. You know, with these accountancy firms all cutting back on graduate trainees, are you saying that's not widely the case?
Yeah. So we're not
from your market.
We're not experiencing that significantly. However, the graduate market at the moment is tough, and there are about a 33% decline year on year in terms of the number of roles being advertised. They're talking about being the worst, some data that it was the worst kind of market at the moment for graduates since 2018.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah. But what we're seeing from the big blue chips is stability. However, back to my point earlier is that only about 10% of graduates go into classic kind of graduate schemes. So if you think more about those kind of SMEs and smaller businesses, and it's hard to distill, isn't it? Is it AI that's causing this reduction in vacancies? Is it the general kind of economic environment? You've got the 20 billion kind of jobs tax. So what is actually behind it?
Economic malaise, perhaps. But I think that AI is having a growing impact.
Yeah,
would be my observation.
I would agree.
Automation is widespread.
Yes.
And I think one challenge for, I'm not just saying you and your business, but us as a society, is all these young people are going to be coming out of university, probably looking for, broadly speaking, what would have been described as white-collar jobs.
Yeah.
And they're going to be increasingly scarce.
I think
so
there's...
So where next, I suppose? What do we do? Because you want to keep placing them and keep them engaged and happy with your platform. And as a country, we need to make sure that we don't have great cohorts of people who are disappointed and out of work.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the big emphasis here is to make sure that young people are getting up to speed on AI and making sure they are getting skilled in that area so that they are competitive. Back to your point earlier about kind of making sure that people engage with their career early on and don't kind of disengage, because those kind of graduates who haven't done much, they are probably the ones kind of most at risk because it isn't a competitive market. A big phenomenon we've seen in our sector is the number of applications per vacancy rocketing up due to AI. So
what do you mean?
The number of applications has gone from about 80 applications per graduate role to about 120. And
so a 50% increase.
Yeah. And that's
what do you mean by that? What's AI got to do with it?
So it's doing two things. Firstly, it's making it easier for graduates to put in applications using AI. So our own research on Bright Network suggests that about 50% of students are using AI in their application, which is up from 38% kind of last year.
Well, you should discount the other 50%. They're obviously not.
Yeah, well, you
switched on.
Well, interestingly, happens to them. Interestingly, 40% of firms aren't giving guidance about AI use. So some firms.
Well, all the firms are using it, aren't they?
Yeah, well, the firms are using it, but some firms are saying, basically, kind of, you know, use it in the right way. Other firms are saying, use it, just please don't use it. Interestingly, when we ask our members, would they comply with rules set down by firms that have said, please don't use it, they say the vast majority say they would kind of comply with the rules in terms of hopefully being kind of ethical. And then the other thing is, obviously, there are these bots.
They're not going to say the opposite, are they?
No. I don't know. I'm a generally believe in being kind of quite ethical, but you never know.
Well, I'm feeling slightly aggrieved for a lot of these young people in that I'm hearing stories of companies using AI to interview people.
Yeah.
So you've come across that. You're nodding.
Yeah.
What's going on? How does that work? And is it acceptable for a computer to reject a human being?
No, I think there should always be a human decision in any hiring.
But that's not happening, though, is it?
Yeah, I personally, I think there should always be.
I know, so do I, but that's not happening now. These companies, a lot of them, these big blue chips you describe, are using this software to sort of screen people out.
I think there should always be ethically a kind of a human decision at some point in their prison. But the problem
works now, because they've also then got so many applicants, haven't they, as you're saying.
Well, imagine having 120 applicants for every job. And the other
that's way, not ideal, no.
No, the other way that candidates are using AI is, you know, there are bots now where you can literally set the bot up to go and apply for jobs for you. And the next day you can wake up and have interviews arranged.
A rejection from AI. I was on the radio the other day, and there was a woman who had applied for 647 trainee accountancy jobs, and she'd finally got one.
Great.
So all credit to her, but she'd been doing it two a day, so she wasn't using AI, but it had taken her a long time, which I think a lot of people are in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the market has been kind of really thrown by AI because the employers are having to come up with new solutions because they're obviously flooded with applications. And, you know, there's a whole kind of reordering going on. But that's a great example there about kind of back to advice for young people is that really understanding what employers want is absolutely critical. And what that young lady there has shown is resilience. So on our Bright Network research, when we ask employers, what do you want and what are you after? The number one thing they will say is passion for the business, but the number two thing is resilience. Now, students and young people only rank resilience about kind of seventh in terms of what they think employers are after. Instead, students and young people think the thing that employers really want is a 2-1. And actually, employers only rank that as about the 10th most important thing.
A 2-1.
Yeah. So I think
that's a degree grade.
Sorry, degree grade.
I've never asked anyone in my 30-year career what their degree
grade
is.
Absolutely, yeah. Exactly. I don't know why I worked so hard at university. Well, it was a bit of a waste of time looking back.
No, I'm not interested in their history skills.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So I think back to your point about what advice can we give young people is we can do, I guess, for example, the great work you're doing here and making kind of explaining kind of commercial awareness and really educating young people about kind of what employers are looking for is key, making sure they're getting up to speed and developing their skills, staying competitive. And I think kind of the key thing is this reminder that change really is the only constant. That is, you know, how you handle uncertainty. And that's where resilience is so critical, right?
So yeah, I'm still thinking about this because you just told me, and this isn't, I'm not trying to catch you out here, I'm genuinely interested. The jobs advertisers are now getting 120 applicants on average, up from 80. And we're talking about members or candidates who have applied for many, many jobs to employers who say they want passion for the company and resilience. Yeah. So the converse of that I'm hearing is, if I said to you, I've applied for 600 jobs, been rejected, but I really love your business and I'd like you to give me a chance, would the 600 rejections make you think better or worse of me?
Well, if I was applying,
you're the person on the other side of the table. Do I want to see this applicant called Reed?
Well, you probably wouldn't disclose him 600.
Well, that's what's interesting to me because I'm thinking back a long time ago. I interviewed a young man who it said on his CV he got a first class degree from Imperial. So I didn't ask him, but it said, and he was obviously super intelligent, and he'd been rejected from all these jobs. So I hired him immediately. And I think he just had a squint or something, you know, something like that, that sort of was, you know, shouldn't have been taken into account at all. But I think that might have been the reason. So when he told me I'd been rejected from every, I hired him immediately. And he was brilliant.
He turned out well.
Yeah.
Great.
So in a way, it might be the people who keep going are the ones you want, aren't they? The ones who don't get fed up and angry, but they'll just keep trying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, they're the ones we all want.
100%.
And that's how do we identify them and flag them to those organizations? I mean, this is a challenge for us as, you know, people in this space share. I'm asking you for your ideas.
Yeah, well, I think what you've given an example of there is a robust hiring process, because I think the more you can systemize the hiring process and make it more scientific, which you did there, because it sounds like he might have been discounted by previous roles back in the day because of essentially a body language tick, the more you can actually make like a systematic kind of evidence-based hiring decision, which I think employers have made leaps and bounds in that, trying to get rid of things like unconscious bias, just because, you know, somebody has a certain kind of body language quality there you described.
Yeah, I don't know.
And what we see amongst the kind of blue chip employers we work with, because they're obviously pretty robust kind of successful organizations, is a scientific kind of hiring process. And back to kind of how they compete and get the best talents, by casting their net wide, super, super wide, and not, for example, just going after graduates from certain universities or certain degree disciplines or certain backgrounds, they can then filter to find those needles in the haystack.
So what are they looking for? You said resilience was second.
Yeah.
But how can you have passion for an organization that you've never been into and you know so little about? I mean, is that a reasonable request?
I think it is.
How can I suddenly feel passion for Google?
Yeah.
I mean, they're one of your clients.
Well, so.
How do I feel that?
I guess being bought into the Google mission and the kind of culture fit and wanting to have
what's your advice to how do they develop their passion? Because I mean, it takes a bit of time to feel passionate.
Yeah, I guess knowing about the business, knowing what it's kind of trying to achieve, knowing about the mission of the business, the values. I know you have your values at Reed. And I think
you're saying not just do a bit of homework, you're saying immerse yourself in this.
I think the more you can know the organization, the culture you're joining, you think about culture being kind of how things are done around here.
You should ask AI, shouldn't you?
Yeah, well, that might be...
tell me about the culture at Google.
You may say that.
Should. I mean,
it depends on the policy of the company.
Some of these clients might have said, no, don't do that. You've got to use what you can to find out what you can.
Yeah, other qualities, what they're looking for is communication skills. So interestingly, with AI and a lot of hard skills becoming commoditized, we're back to soft skills in terms of how you can influence a team, how you can lead, how you can communicate. So actually, interestingly, softer skills are becoming more important, which is why our research shows that young people are actually now more prone to wanting to go into the office. So 58% of our Bright Network members want to be in the office 4 days or more a week, which is up from 9% last year. So offices are obviously incredible learning machines. And then also problem-solving skills is another thing that employers are really looking for in terms of top of the stack.
Yeah, well, our research shows the same, that Gen Z want to be in the workplace.
Yeah.
And it's often the older people who have nicer homes. And
it's a problem,
dogs
right?
to walk and all that sort of stuff.
And it's very
deliveries
easy
to receive.
Yeah.
But prefer work at home, which I find a bit unconvincing. I think there's a moral. Show up and help the young people get started.
I completely agree. And I think there's a moral argument to it, particularly for those people who've been lucky enough to go through that kind of dynamic office environments. And offices are, as I said, offices are great learning machines. And our research turns out they show to to learn from the older people in the organization. And if they're not there and they're padding around there, you know, they're later in their careers, if we've got nicer houses, there's actually kind of dog to walk, maybe a spouse, so kind of working from home. I think there is a moral responsibility. Yeah,
I'm very worried about all this because I think, you know, a lot of those jobs are just being lined up to be automated or offshore.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you can pad around at home in Croydon or Kingston, you can also pad around at home in Soweto or Hungary somewhere. What's happening. All the jobs are being offshore.
Well, as you know, and you talk about, you know, we have a massive productivity gap in the UK. We're about 20% less productive than
say that again.
About 20% less productive in terms of productivity, aren't we, than kind of mainland Europe?
20%.
Yeah, in terms of it takes them about 4 days. It takes the us about.
So we
five
have
days.
To work 5 days for them. Yeah. To, well, that's 25%, but yeah, not far off.
Yeah, it's and then we know that Britain are the second biggest when it comes to remote work. After Canada, and we also, the research is increasing.
Well, it snows a lot in Canada.
Yeah. that's kind of fair. But we also know that. That remote working overall seems to be less productive. Now, of course, we should have flexible working arrangements, and it's really beneficial for in some sector society, for example, kind of working parents, but it's getting the balance right.
I think that there's every argument for flexibility, but you're right. I wouldn't disagree. And it makes those roles, I think, more at jeopardy.
Yeah.
So your advice to young people is show up.
Get into the office. I think absolutely get into the office, build those relationships, practice those soft skills, practice collaborating, learn from kind of senior people in the business, have those serendipitous conversations about your work, and that will help you get ahead.
You've talked a lot about the companies you deal with.
Yeah.
And you describe them as blue chip. I'm imagining sort of banks, consulting firms, technology firms, companies. Yeah. The sort of names that people would know.
Yes.
It's a certain type of person, is it, who wants to go to the best school and then work in a big bank.
Yeah.
And there are lots of people who don't want to do that, or who would rather be in a smaller environment or work in a non-profit. Or do you cater for them?
Yeah, well, the great thing about the Bright Network platform, it's built as to help young people connect with the world of work. And one of the things I love most about the model is that the platform caters for every undergraduate and student. So even though the firms are using it to kind of engage the talent kind of that they want to hire, if you're not 100% sure what you want to do, or you probably don't want to engage your career, maybe until you've even left university, or you want to go and work for a startup, all the advice and information on those kind of two key things we're solving for, going back to the problem hopefully I was trying to solve that I experienced as a founder, is like, what should I do with my life? Back to your point about what are the opportunities out there? How do I match to a specific career? And secondly, how do I get ahead? We still help you even if you don't go and work at one of our clients.
Mm.
Much as I suppose you're doing at Reed.
Well, we have a lot of clients that are smaller organizations. I mean, we work with big organizations and small. But I just think, in my experience, or just observing, it's often you get a lot of good experience in a smaller organization. Well, you may have to do a bit of everything.
Absolutely.
And if you're just clocked, if you become a specialist in a bigger one. And that's good for early career development.
Yeah, absolutely. And most graduates will actually go and work for an SME. That's where the majority of them go. And as Napoleon said, we're a nation of shopkeepers, right? We've got 5 million SMEs and they are the growth
engine. I don't think he meant that as a compliment.
No, but,
I think he was shown to be foolish in his sneering.
Yeah. I agree. He was definitely meaning it as a put down, but the reality of us having lots of kind of small businesses is the case.
So how do you see the landscape? I mean, you're using AI. Well, yeah. And firstly, I mean, what do you use it for in your business? Because I'd like to understand that. And then how do you see it changing the landscape?
So we brought AI into our business about 4 years ago, so pre-ChatGPT. I was very much onto our tech team, kind of reading articles about what was coming as the business.
So what did you use it
for then? So what we brought it in for then, which is what we use it for now, is the matching. So in terms of the talent on the platform and how we match them to roles, when we introduced AI onto the platform, it introduced our matching ability by about 10x, using the data I was describing earlier in terms of...
So how did that actually improve the matching? Because, I mean, there were matchings... There's been matching software around for a long time.
Yeah. So one of our core products is a personalized newsletter that every one of our members gets. So the roles we list in there So the click-through rates when the matching was done by AI, which previously we were using kind of humans to put these newsletters.
Oh, so the AI would post different jobs to different individuals.
Yes, different jobs. It's completely personalized.
It could mass produce that as well, whereas before it would have been a slow mass process. So it mass produces personalized communications with specific jobs in some maybe of interest to that individual.
That's exactly
but not that individual.
Yeah,
that's so exactly. That's something that wouldn't have been easy to do before AI.
No, 100%.
So you're using it for that?
Yeah, that's been a kind of a
huge part. And how did it improve your business?
Well, so it improved the matching rate by 10x. So if you think about our job being, we've got these 1.2 million Bright Network members, we've got these 300 corporates, and we're trying to kind of more efficiently match them. So a use case might be a young person who has no idea they could go and work in a sector earning a huge salary, gets put in front of them a role that they wouldn't even thought they were a good match for, but actually all the data suggests they could be a really good match for it. And then they apply for that role, they get the role, the client's really happy because they've got a super great hire, the young person's really happy, that creates obviously a case study, so that becomes quite powerful.
But you don't necessarily track who's hired who.
We are able to kind of track to hire.
Do you use AI to do that?
We don't use AI to do that, but we do use a data platform we built where the employers can see actually which of their young people have come from Bright Network.
Right. And has your business grown as a result of this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's encouraging for people who want jobs. So 4 years ago to now, how's it grown?
Well, in terms of our kind of headcount we've probably gone from about maybe about 40, something like that, kind of 4 years ago to about roughly the headcount size, about 100 now.
Right. So, but those people wouldn't be doing that task.
No, but our overall revenue has grown, which has meant more marketing people, more kind of people to look after our clients.
You to grow in other areas.
Yeah.
So would you say that was a key decision, a key moment for you doing that? Or were there other things that happened 4 years ago or since?
In terms of kind of powering our growth?
Yeah,
I think investment in technology. We've raised venture capital and we've put a lot of that money into technology. And that then has given us some more of a competitive edge in the market in terms of us becoming number one player in our very specific part of the jobs markets. And then other things we've done that has really kind of powered our growth has been investing in bringing more students onto the platform. So obviously the bigger audience we have, the more...
How do you do that? I mean, I'm just interested in anyone who's starting a business who wants to sort of create a network or... It's quite hard to do, isn't it? I mean, there are not many social networks.
No, it's building it from scratch and the kind of cold start problem. And I was able to
What did you do?
Well, so initially I had access to my database of students, my previous business. That kind of was like the catalyst. And then it was a lot of getting out on campus, getting into universities, building relationships.
So literally pounding the pavement.
Yeah, absolutely. We used to give out mugs, actually, which is a great kind of story. Although, if someone signed up, they got a Bright Network mug, or they hadn't really thought through the logistics of casting around all these mugs around campus. That was quite a big operational experience. And then we also kind of build relationships with societies. But now we've got to a point in terms of our audience where because we're the number one, because the product is so good for young people, it creates kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Now, one of my young graduate colleagues told me she'd done one of your internships.
Oh, great. Okay,
how did she find it? She said it was very good.
Excellent.
And she said it gave her a bit of confidence and it also ticked off a box that was required.
Great. Well, they're allowed to put it on their CV and then the syllabus as well.
I think she thought it was a very good.
Great one. Please do that.
Intervention on your part.
Bright Network members everywhere. Yeah, great.
So you go to Bright Network if you want to do an internship and it's easy to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it doesn't cost the member anything.
Completely free. It's all free for the members. Right. We're trying to solve those two problems. What should I do with my life and how do I get ahead?
So AI you've found helpful in your business. But I suppose it's interesting. In that example you described, it's sort of doing a job that a person wasn't actually able to do before in your case. I mean, it must be in other businesses doing jobs that people were able to do before. I mean, you're saying you're sort of seeing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where do you think this is headed? Because, you want to place graduates into jobs. You're using AI.
Yeah.
You're probably looking at other ways to use AI. Where's it headed from here? Because 2025, I think, will be thought of as the year of AI. The year it became sort of mainstream, widely deployed. Everyone using it, really. Some better than others.
Yes.
Where's it going next?
Well, the tech community seems pretty kind of split on, is AI a good thing or a bad thing? personally, I think it's going to have a hugely, and it's already having a hugely transformative impact on society. And I think, I think insidiously it is going to be taking kind of jobs that we might not see all the time, because essentially it's making kind of people kind of more productive. And if you think about, like, for example, junior technology roles or marketeer roles, arguably you do need less of these people. So the emphasis is on the young people to stay competitive. Ultimately, kind of for us, great organizations are always going to want to hire great entry-level talents. And our job is to make sure that, our mission in terms of building the workforce of tomorrow is to make sure that talent is aware of how far it can go and the opportunities out there. So, yeah, we're moving to potentially a very disruptive time, and we've got to make sure that young people are equipped for this.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that being equipped for this is an interesting question. You know, how do we equip people for something that's so hard to foretell?
I think coming back to, obviously, we can do kind of the basic things like encourage them to use AI and maybe even like start building into the syllabus, etc. But I think it's this idea of this kind of growth mindset, which is one of the three values of our business, is how do you kind of handle change and being able to adapt to new environments is we need as much as a country. And if you think about our position as a country and where we are, we need to be showing as much resilience as possible and adapting to the kind of changes that are coming.
So you said growth mindset was one of your values. I just want to know what the other two are.
Yeah. So will to win.
Will to win.
In terms of kind of being competitive and wanting to be the best. And that's hopefully kind of done well for us in terms of becoming number one in the market. And then the final one is trusted to deliver. The idea of, like, we are trusted by our client partners to deliver every year. They pay us to do a job and we do that job and we...
So when they subscribe with you... I just want to understand, what is the job that they expect you to do?
Because generate high quality applications
just so that through these mailings,
and yeah,
so that people keep coming into there.
Yeah, and various other things on our tech platform as well, and then hire great talents, and then using us again the following year, because it's a very cyclical business.
And is it very seasonal?
Yes, it's a very, very seasonal business.
So when is it super busy?
So typically applications are open from very roughly period kind of September to January for third year, second year, and first year internships. So quite a small window. And some of those are very specific in terms of kind of, they might only be able to, like, a month window when they're open, which again, I had no idea when I was at university, when I was working the pub. So our ability to tell students when to apply for certain roles. And that's a tip I'd give to any student listening to this, is really think about when employers are advertising vacancies, and then they review the campaigns typically in kind of the first kind of half of the year, and then they will book in their campaigns the following year. So the kind of classic milk round season in terms of timing, it's been elongated and kind of messed around, has changed a little bit, but it's still really there in terms of applications.
So do companies still show up on campus and stuff?
Yeah, so they still go on campus.
They still do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the great thing the Bright Network platform has enabled is, by putting all students in the same place, it's made those kind of things a little bit more efficient, I think. We do a big event every year called Bright Network Festival, which has about 4,000 come to it.
Oh, great. That sounds like a good event to attend.
You should come along and have a look.
I will.
You should come and do it. It's the Queen Elizabeth Conference Centre, directly opposite Westminster. Have about 4,000 come along. And we'd love to kind of have you there if you want to come and do a How to Be a Successful Entrepreneur talk or whatever you want to talk about.
That's very kind. I might take you up on that.
That'd be great.
So one of the motivations, I understand, behind you sort of setting up the business in this way was to try and make things fairer in the job market. Particularly for people with what are described as protected characteristics, but people from minority groups or people with disabilities. What have you done to sort of make that happen?
So this is where the AI and data and tech gets really interesting, because through that you can create kind of better matching. So 60% of people from ethnic minority backgrounds still believe that their background is holding them back. 40% from social mobility backgrounds believe their backgrounds holding them back. So by coming back to the tap on the shoulder and putting the right opportunities in front of you, whatever your backgrounds, not just because you're at a certain university, it allows the matching to work a lot more efficiently.
So these people feel this even if they're at these high-end universities?
Yeah. Yeah, there's
they don't feel because they've got to Cambridge that
and imposter syndrome's a huge thing as well.
It's still an issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they might have come from a family that no one had been university.
Yeah, first generation university, or
and they still feel that this is holding them back.
Yeah, that there's still a perception of that. So what we try to do,
is there a truth in that?
So the data doesn't suggest so. But
it's more perception than reality.
Yeah, absolutely. So the big thing,
but the important thing to know is not true.
Yeah, absolutely. Like firms want the best and brightest from all backgrounds.
Do.
Yeah, it's irrelevant, so, right? It's absolutely
completely. Yeah, I'm so disappointed that people are still feeling that.
Yeah, there is that perception. So we also run kind of super targeted events. For example, we do a Black Talent in Banking events. We do like a Proud to Be events. Like we do a Neurodiverse Leaders events. So looking and really trying to give specific help to people to create a quality of opportunity and giving them the advice and information they need to succeed ensures that they have kind of fair access.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other, I've observed sort of changes is that some companies have sort of reined in their graduate programs because they want to make sure they recruit people from a whole range of backgrounds.
And
they
thought military that, or yeah.
Yeah, and they thought that people from universities were sort of a certain type. And so they might not take as many or they might not do it in the same way. Are they wrong to do that now?
Well, the reality is that students at university are incredibly diverse in terms of...
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was at university, they were not.
Yeah, but now they are.
So does that sort of change the sort of thinking a bit?
I think firms should be as inclusive as possible and reaching out to as wider candidate pool as possible, be that on university or encouraging, kind of returners to work after paternity or maternity, etc. So yeah, having a broad reach as possible, however you want to do that, and having a very systemic, organized recruitment process gives you a competitive advantage. So kind of go broad, get out to as many applicants as possible, and then make sure your recruitment process is as robust as possible.
So do you anonymize people? So you don't do that?
No.
Some people argue that's what should be.
But because we're generating applications for the firms, some firms will then be, kind of like have scrap CVs, for example. That's been something that's kind of been a bit of a phenomenon, not looking at academics. So yeah, there is some movements like that happening in the market.
But is that, I've heard that too, but they never seem to last very long. People say, I want to know what.
I guess it depends how well HR has trained the interviewer.
But is that a bad thing to know that though? I mean, it's part of your sort of life journey, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're saying
on the one hand, these clients want students from these top universities, and then on the other, they can't see.
So I did say they want students from the top university. I think there is a
isn't that the product here, partly?
I think things have changed. So some firms would just go to top universities, and now they're able to kind of target all universities with platforms like Bright Network because they're able to get kind of broader access in terms of all those candidates being on the platform. I do think kind of academics can obviously show something, and if you've got a first from,
it shows how good you are at academics.
Well, it can show certain things, right? But it can show in terms of.
But certain jobs, if you're going to be a doctor or something, it's pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a vocational angle, and there's also good academics can be a signal of kind of cognitive speed and ability, for example. But what you want to make sure is that you're giving kind of fair access to, say, for example, there's a student who. Grew up on a council estate as a first generation to go to university, and then maybe they haven't gone to a top tier university because maybe they weren't encouraged by their school to apply to a top tier university. Through the Luxor Bright Network, they can still then access top employers and making sure they get fair advantage.
And importantly, I'm thinking the top employer can access them.
100%.
Because you want those people in your organization because they'll bring a lot with them.
Yeah, absolutely. They bring the kind of hunger and the drive. And arguably, a candidate like that has actually proved a greater distance traveled than a student who's gone to a top private school, got the top grades, and gone to a top university.
Yeah. They haven't had any setbacks.
No. Back to our point, the resilience is still to be found. Yeah.
One thing I'd say that you said that companies, said passion for the company and resilience were the top two. When I did a huge piece of research, I mean, it's more than 12 years ago now, asking companies what they were looking for in terms of mindset qualities. The thing that came top always was integrity and trustworthiness. Yeah. You know, you don't want to hire a crook. Yeah. You want people to show up on time.
Yes.
Is that not still the case?
Yeah, it's not.
And they don't talk about that in schools and colleges.
Yeah, I mean, values is obviously kind of critically important. And
well,
Personal values. It's not something.
Well, you don't go and say to someone in the job interview, I'm not a crook.
No.
So how do you come across as someone who's sort of honest and upright? Because that's what they want.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not something that they, I guess, it would come out generally through the graduate kind of recruitment process in terms of kind of looking for, you know, what is the composition of someone's kind of character. And I think, you know, they're hopefully maybe kind of taking people at kind of face value more. And I think this is where probation periods come in, because you obviously only know what an individual is really like until they've started.
Yeah, I mean, you can be, and people change as well. So it's it's so important, I think, the sort of integrity aspect.
Yes.
So we developed the 3G mindset.
Okay,
in our book, the Put Your Mindset to Work, which was written years ago, first G was good.
Yeah.
And that was integrity and kindness. So two types of good. The second G was grit,
yeah,
as in resilience and persistence, which you've absolutely settled on and stuff. And the third G was global, which was open growth mindset. Could have been growth. And those were the three things, you know, that we sort of summarized they were looking for.
I think they're great. I would say you should write a book. Yeah. You've already done it.
Maybe we should do a sequel.
Yeah.
But I think that, but I remember, and this book was prompted at the time by someone saying at a conference I was at, they were from some skills body from the government, you know, what skills will most be in demand in 10 years time? So we're talking like now, back 10 years ago. And I was sitting there thinking, well, I've no idea what skills will be most in demand in 10. I mean, I didn't know I was going to be working podcast producers, but I do know what sort of people I want to hire in 10 years time.
Yes.
And they have these qualities. And these characteristics.
Yeah, these fundamental kind
of underlying. So you're doing the same in a sense.
Yeah, these fundamental underlying kind of qualities, values, characteristics, because they last forever, right?
Character is everything.
Kind of change being the only constants.
Yeah.
Those fundamental underlying qualities are often what makes high performance.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's potentially
the
one constant that doesn't change.
Yeah.
So is there anything you'd like to add about how your business is going to evolve from here into the future? Do you have any ambitious plans or some initiatives coming out you want to share? Because I'm intrigued.
Yes, so continuing to invest in our technology is the number one kind of focus, because that then continues to give us an edge in the market. And we're also working on some quite interesting technology at the moment that looks at how employers can handle kind of mass applications and AI. So we've got some interesting stuff in the pipeline there. That allows kind of candidates and employers to kind of think about how they use AI when it comes to the application process. So that's quite interesting. Our tech hub is based up in Edinburgh. So we've got some interesting kind of work happening there, which is exciting. And
so do you do that in-house?
Yeah, all of our technology is done in-house.
Right.
So we've got Edinburgh? Yeah, in Edinburgh, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Is there a sort of tech, sort of Silicon Glen, is it called?
Yeah. So we set up in Edinburgh because we had our tech hub in London, but we found it incredibly competitive to hire talent and to get the kind of right people. And our CTO at the time, funnily enough, got located to Edinburgh, and we thought it would be really interesting to kind of build a tech hub up there. And it's actually worked really, really well in terms of kind of the phenomenal talent up there and kind of building some
people like living there.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great city, isn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. We did that. We put a tech team in Sligo in the west of Ireland.
Did you really? Wow. Is it still there?
People love living there and working there. And there's a very good tech college not far away, which people graduate from and join us.
Do they? Fantastic. So, How many have you got there?
Only about 20, but it's good. They do really good work. So I think that's quite interesting because there's a great sense of there's a great gravitational pull of, you know, being in, you know, well, ultimately, Silicon Valley, I suppose, but there are other ways of approaching tech, especially if you're a smaller business or a startup entrepreneur.
Yeah, you've got to be agile, and we've got about 15 up there now, so it's worked really well.
Yeah. Oh, well, I wish you continuing success
with
that. Look forward to seeing how the business evolves. Now, I've got two questions that I always ask at the end, James.
Right.
And the first question, there's a clue on the wall, is what gets you up on a Monday morning?
A lot of Mondays, yeah. I think for me, it's the mission in the business and unleashing the talent of our Bright Network members. And the wonderful thing we get in testimonials, having kind of had our members sign up when they're 18 at Lambda University and then get these incredible jobs, is just seeing how far they can go. And I think everybody can probably go further than they think they can with the right support and help. And I had that support and help when I was at school, and had this incredible teacher who encouraged me to apply to a top university. So I think it's the mission for me, and unleashing kind of the talent on Bright Network to go far.
You said something interesting, or just caught my attention. Everyone can go further than they think they can.
Yeah.
So you're saying we've got sort of hidden potential.
I think
so. Or
hidden
from ourselves.
Yeah.
I think that idea.
Yeah. And I think it's the power of having somebody believe in you. So at Bright Network, our big thing is like believing in our members, backing them, being on their side, again, much like that kind of older brother or sister. And we think about kind of having...
You must have had a nice older brother or
yeah,
sister.
No, yeah.
not every relationship is like that.
Well, technically, I was an only child. So I don't know.
You have a utopian view of brothers and sisters. But I know what you mean.
Yeah, and that's where kind of like...
Someone on your side.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the...
Cheering you on.
Absolutely, with mentoring, almost like the difference between kind of mentoring with a capital M and a little M. You can have kind of like, you know, proper kind of mentors with a capital M, who, you know, you meet up with now and then and kind of like try and help you develop. And you can have mentors with a little M who are like, you know, you're learning from in the office or seeing stuff. So having somebody believe in you. And again, if you think about how we try and power more social mobility about what works in these kind of, again, these kind of wealthy, well-connected families, is they've got somebody believing in them, often these kids, and gunning for them. And we try and do that on Bright Network for every one of our members. So that's what gets me out of bed every morning.
That's great. And my last question, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
In 5 years' time, kind of building Bright Network, the business is growing, developing. We've got a lot of opportunities in the business, and the big things are our alumni. So once our members get their first job, we've created this kind of hyper-personalized network of talents who know us, know Bright Network. We've, in terms of being trusted to deliver, we've delivered great results for them. They've gone and got their first job. So that's an interesting kind of growth opportunity for us as well. Overseas is also an interesting opportunity for us.
I was wondering that. You mentioned you might be going into, well, you're opening in Germany.
Yeah, we opened Germany 2 years ago. Yeah,
it was 2 years. So yep. Have you got any other countries you're looking at?
Just that so far. Yeah,
so I mean, we picked Germany one because, at a time.
Yeah, we're learning about international and how to do it. And we picked Germany because it was where our clients asked us to go. So we spoke to our clients.
They wanted
Germany.
Yeah. Not America.
They did want America as well. And the reason we didn't go for America first was because it's a significant amount of capital to launch well in America. And so we wanted to learn about international first.
So that could be next.
Yeah. America could be next.
Well, I wish you every success with that.
Thank you very much.
I'll get you back in 5 years' time and see how it's going.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I really enjoyed it. Right, thanks very much.
So have I. Thank you for coming to talk to me.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, James, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reid, Chairman and CEO of Reid, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reid, James Uffindell, and Bright Network, all links are in the show notes. See you next time.